fear and hate are emotions, and courage and kindness are decisions. Most have experienced that where you're again making those goals and you're setting those goals, but somehow you just feel that this goal is quite fluffy. It's somehow you can see a world where in a when we get to the point where we looked at whether we actually reached it or not, we can make it to be anything. Yes, we reached it because we tried our best or something like that. So one of the things that we've found that works sometimes is that we ask that, what might be something that we can fail at by this time? Or what's the failure? So rather than actually talking about the measurement or the success case, let's talk about what would the failure look like?
How do you deal with that personally whenever those entrepreneurial falls happen? What are your steps to get yourself through that moment?
I think it's a combination of many things. For me, passion is like fire. It's a great servant, but an extremely poor master. That when you go to that mode, that this needs to work, and I'm getting up like just to kind of all of a sudden, kind of the passion has been taking the driver's seat, and you're just serving the passion, and you're just kind of, that's the point where you need to stop and figure out how do you make the passion again a servant and not a master. If you're not consciously making the decision to do that, I give you like 6 months before you're burned out. I think it would be an extremely sad thing if people do not start those ventures that try to help the world just because they feel that they don't live completely up to a standard that might be actually impossible to live to in many cases.
Looking for smart stats about leadership and personal development? Then sorry, this show is not for you. On The Genius Leadership, we share relatable stories of real people and give you practical tools for personal and professional development so that you can start implementing them right away. I'm your host, Anna Lieben, Mindshifter, helping leaders get from reacting to creating. And Genius Leadership is about elevating humanity, one person at a time. Let's go. Tuomo, warmest welcome to The Genius Leadership.
Thank you so much for having me.
First of all, I'm curious about you. Who is Tuomo and what would you like to share as your background for the conversation we're just to have?
Yes, sure. So Tuomo is a person who went to a university called Aalto University back in the day, 2012, if I remember correctly. I studied at a program called Information Networks, which is it's a combination of business, technology, and arts, and then kind of all of those three in the context of society. So figuring kind of it originated from the place of that kind of some people somewhere understood that we need individuals that understand kind of the technological future, understand the human side of that. So kind of the art side and then the business side of how do companies actually incorporate digitalization into their businesses? And then more and more around kind of the societal aspects of that. What is response kind of responsible or sustainable technology and everything from accessibility to then to kind of course, around that point, all of the positive and negative sides of social media started to be more in the news and such. So there was a lot of that. And then that's where kind of Tuomo started and met all of his co-founders. One of the co-founders I met already when doing my military service in the army. But then in that university group, we kind of found the core group and since then have been working together in various ways and then founding Twice Commerce and building what it is today.
What brought you to the military? Was it a mass education or service?
So yeah, it's a compulsory thing in Finland. So we have there's probably a lot better people in explaining the system, but you have different, you can do civil service or then the military service.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Was there anything from that military experience of yours that you're using nowadays as a founder or for yourself personally?
Yeah, sure. I think there's actually quite a lot. There's like practical stuff from having gone to kind of the officer school and all of that. There's a lot of that you learn about yourself and kind of you go there as a quite young person. You're 20, like 18 or 20. You really kind of can learn all of the, get a lot of experience in understanding how bad you might be as a leader. I'd say it that way. But also you get those experiences that where you kind of can overcome yourself and you work as a team and so on. And then a lot of structure around communication and on delegation and elevation. Then I happen to have a thing that is not part of the compulsory army, but during my military service, I was hit by lightning in one of the exercises. And that as a individual, event in my life changed somewhat my kind of way of looking at things and way of looking at life. Kind of when you have that couple of hundred million volts going go through you, you kind of you experience some stuff that helps you maybe prioritize things later on.
Honestly, I didn't know that you can survive those and actually be fully functional later on. So that's news to me. But what was going through you after that? So obviously then it was volt going through you. But afterwards, what did you reevaluate or understood for yourself?
I think that could be a episode by itself, kind of a podcast episode by itself. But I think on a big picture, a couple of things happened that maybe relate to more of the business side of my thinking later on. One of the things is that, well, first of all, your kind of, let's say, Maslow's hierarchy gets quite explicit. So you understand the things that matter in life and what doesn't. And then every time if you kind of lose that a little bit, then you can go back to that memory and figure out what did you actually think about when you were in this a little bit more, let's say, painful, stressful situation. So it wasn't maybe your latest reports or such. It's quite a kind of, you know, family, spouse, friends, and so on that go through your mind. Then the other aspect is that, you know, you get to experience this like, well, specifically with the lightning strike, I think it's like extremely small odds that this happens. So you kind of get this belief that everything's possible. And so if someone says that there's not so big odds of this happening or something, you say that, you know, I've experienced small odds before also. So even though it's probably statistically not the best approach, but I think it gives you this emotional power to get through those tough times and moments and kind of believe in small odds and the ability to kind of build cool stuff to the world and positive stuff to the world, even if the odds might be stacked against you.
Wow, that's definitely a learning that must be very helpful as entrepreneur. And Tomo, now let's go back to your education and from there to Twice Commerce. There have been several steps in between. You co-founded some other companies as well. So what kind of industries were you getting into? Why entrepreneurship? What drives you with those initiatives that you're taking in your career?
Yeah, I think, well, actually the companies beforehand, they were, in my opinion, like when you look back, they were all kind of connected to where we are now. So the very first company that we built, or the idea, more, I think it was more of an idea than a company that we had and started to build a solution around, which was kind of this local marketing. It's almost like nowadays you could say it was Yodel for micro kind of brick and mortar stores. How could they do local marketing? And it started with this idea of how do you Google a sound that you hear nearby? So that, you know, it's not indexed anywhere. So it's a local thing that has happened. And how do you kind of crowdsource information? But we, at that point, we kind of lacked pretty much everything that would have been needed to kind of take that idea to anything serious. Then after that, around that time, there was City Bikes in Helsinki that came as a service. So already in early 2000, we had City Bikes, but they worked with €2 coins as deposits. And then I think it was at the end of the season, like half of the bikes were in the Cedar River, essentially. So €2 maybe isn't enough to incentivize a maybe intoxicated young teenage, often male, to return a bike to the right place. So then years go on, we are at the university, it's maybe 2015 or something. There's a new cohort of City Bikes that come to Helsinki. It's kind of the same, they're different color, and then instead of €2 coins, they work with this automated lock system that is connected to an extremely lightweight Stripe account. Essentially, you need to attach your credit card to that bike. And then if you don't return it, it keeps charging you by time. And it goes up to like 500 or so. And the outcome of that was that instead of half of the bikes being the City River, maybe two of them were. And as students and as entrepreneurial minds, we got super hooked to that. Like having just studied technology and UX and that kind of societal context of that, and we started to think that how could we utilize this same mechanism to some other use case and make people behave and share stuff better. Mm-hmm. And that's really how we got to our second business, which was around renting power banks. Probably the idea came from the fact that I had the crappiest iPhone. It ran out of battery in like 2 hours or so. I was also working at the largest telco in Finland at the same time, doing new business development ideas there, and kind of the power banks and phones and everything was kind of part of my life then. That again, we had a great product, but not so good of a business model. So, but that via that, we ended up building a lot of commerce software for renting and similar, which then ended up kind of becoming the what Twice is, kind of that was the origin of Twice, us building software for ourselves as we, and then understanding that it's actually the software side of things that the world needs. And we need better infrastructure for anyone with business ideas that are sustainable and so on. And that's how we kind of got to Twice and beyond.
So can you explain to us what Twice is? Because when I read it on the LinkedIn, your description of Twice, it's about enabling businesses to sell products multiple times. And it sounds like a scam to me. Like, okay, how can I sell the same thing twice? It's like something is fishy here. So what do you actually mean?
Yeah, there are some middle steps there. So we tried to simplify, because I think, well, in general, sustainability and circular economy, there are extremely important phenomenons, but they're filled with academic words. And they are sometimes hard, not necessarily hard to grasp, but they're not like present in your life every day. So previously, Twice and our company was called Rental, and it was kind of, we talked about access to goods and renting and so on. Because if you think about what, for example, rentals are, it's selling access to a good, then selling it again and again and again and again. You essentially sell the same item unlimited amounts. So, and instead of selling something once, which is kind of the one-off consumption world, and selling the ownership of goods, you sell it twice. So that's kind of selling something twice or more means renting or subscription, but it also means things like secondhand or refurbished sales. And there, of course, you have the middle step that once you've sold it out, you need to trade it in or buy it back as a retailer or manufacturer there in between before you being able to sell it out again. But effectively, for anyone to sell stuff more than twice, they need to have a system where they can take back goods, or they can receive back the goods that they own, or then buy them from the market. And if they're able to do that, they're able to kind of improve their gross margins quite drastically. Because in that second sale, you don't have any more of those manufacturing costs and all of those built in, and the unit economics start to work. So for us, Twice is, as a name, tries to simplify an extremely complex thing, and saying that, stemming from our history, that there's a lot of companies that help you with the kind of physical good, the operations and so, and all of that. But we really want to enable the technology infrastructure for that. So we want to help companies go from selling something once to selling them twice or more, because we know if you can sell something, selling something once is hard, selling something twice is hard. But then if you can sell something twice, you can do it as many times. And then that starts to sound like, I don't know, the fundamentals of circular economy, that stuff is, you do stuff more than twice.
Mm. It sounds fantastic, but then I could imagine that people listen to that and say like, yeah, okay, it's good for the planet, it's good for my consciousness maybe. But business-wise, okay, you said that, okay, we're minimizing the manufacturer, or like eliminating manufacturing costs from the second sale and onwards. But does it still make a business sense, or financial sense?
Yeah. To answer that question, we would kind of, it is extremely dependent on the kind of product category, the durability of the product, mm-hmm. and the repairability of the product, and your kind of backstream infrastructure. So I tend to use an example that there's no business in renting white t-shirts, but there definitely is a business in taking back those white t-shirts, turning them back to fiber, and remanufacturing those t-shirts. Now, in order to do that, it is dependent on many things. That first of all, you know, you have that ability to take in a white t-shirt and turn it back to fiber. There's a lot of companies that work on that context, and there's a lot of regulative needs, like that if that white t-shirt is supposed to be 100% cotton, that it actually is, and it's not 1% plastic, for example. So there's a lot of these regulative things like digital product passports and such that try to solve that thing. So it does make a business case. In many of those less durable goods, it's still, I'd say, waiting for a time where this ability to turn items back to kind of core atoms and then remanufacturing them, that infrastructure is in place. But there are categories like electronics where that's already a booming business. Mm-hmm. Refurbished smartphones is a big, big market. There are more of these kind of sporting equipment categories where renting is kind of a built-in thing. So there are quite a lot of use cases where it makes sense, and collectibles and all of that kind of, it is still a big market. And if I don't remember wrong, it's like $500 billion worth of unused goods sitting in US American households, essentially just dropping in value, most of those. that could be used by someone else or taken back to the manufacturers to be remanufactured. So there is a huge business case there, for sure.
Fascinating. Yeah, and I also, for example, know that EU is trying to provide or regulate that market more and more. For example, the hospitality business, they will need to pay fines for all the textiles they just dump. For example, hotels use a lot, right, with the bed sheets and towels, and it's quite an intense use cycle there. So they don't live as long, but then they will need to pay the government for all the, like, per ton or per kilo, however they count, for just dumping it. But then if there are startups nowadays looking at that, like, okay, how can we do that? We collect that from them and we do something else from them, because it's still quite okay material for something else, making cloth for, like, cloth for cleaning or anything like that. So, and usually those are quite nice materials, right? Depending, of course, on the hotel chain. So there will be more and more cases, I suppose, where it becomes an obvious business case to work towards a circular solutions within different branches or with different industries of businesses.
Yeah, definitely.
But I also want to touch on, we might have listeners who don't have any products that they produce and sell, so they won't be able to resell. If it's a business owner who is making software, providing a software as a service solution, or service provider, anything that they could think about when it comes to circularity, where they can improve their business?
Yeah, sure. So as an example, we are one of those companies. We are a technology-only provider. So at the end of the day, the impact that we have is often the impact of someone else, kind of someone else doing a better job with their impact. And then kind of we're not able to own that in accounting, kind of carbon accounting or similar wise. So in that way, we've kind of thought quite a lot about this and tried to understand how do we kind of stay true to our own measurement of impact. So for a software company, you have these things like servers running and they're consuming electricity. And there's a lot of small decisions, or they can be big decisions also, but like I'd say tactical decisions that you can do, that where do you host your servers? Do those data centers use green energy or not? So you can kind of try to make your decisions on this level. The other thing is this concept that we learned originally from a company called Upright, if I remember correctly, where in technology companies, you tend to employ quite a lot of people that are highly educated, or at least society has invested quite a lot into their education and careers and skill sets. So the question really is that how do these individuals use their brain power? Kind of all of the investments that have been put into them, how do you operationalize that? Do you work in a context or company where you're kind of enabling other companies have a better impact? Or are you trying to kind of sell, let's say, more ads in a given forum or similar? So that is a one big measurement. It's, of course, a hard thing to measure, but as a high-level sanity check, I think that's one of the things. It's as an individual thinking that you could be doing anything in your life with the brain power that you have. Where are you now putting that computational power? Do you wake up every day trying to solve a problem in the sustainability field? Or do you wake up every day and spend 12 hours in a work environment where you don't solve those problems, and then maybe as a consumer just do conscious decisions? And I'm not valuing either or in any way, but that's, I think, one of the things how at least we try to look at that and figure out. Of course, there's no accounting system for that to say that, hey, someone went to MIT and now they're thinking about sustainability, so now they have a positive impact to the world. But maybe that as a thought might help some of the digital companies.
Mm. I actually want to emphasize how interesting that idea is from the leadership perspective. So when someone is listening to us who is the founder or CEO of a company, and they can make decisions of their brilliant talent, like how to use the talent and, as you say, brain power of their people. Because I work enough with leaders who have difficulty delegating, letting go of control. And then here is another prompt for you, dear genius leaders. Think about, like, are you getting the best return on investment? And not only investment of you investing in this person as an employee, but the societal investment into this person and to get them where they are right now, so that you hire them and you actually want to get a value out of them for the company. Are you making the biggest bang for the buck there, right? With actually using their brain power for something impactful, to create a better business case for your company, to bring more value to your customers, to keep people more happy and engaged in the workplace and so on. That could be a very interesting exercise to do as a leader for all the employees you have, and just looking at the tasks those employees have and reflecting on that perspective. Is it the best use of their brain power?
Definitely. I think there's a, it comes from, I think originally I heard it from a Finnish entrepreneur called Kristo Ovaska, who's founder of Smartly, who at least to me coined the sentence, elevate and not delegate. And I think it's this conscious decision-making by leaders that how am I elevating people around me, or am I just delegating tasks forward? So like if you force yourself into that elevation mindset, you are then forced to also figure out ways on how do you enable people make bigger decisions? How do you enable them to take risks in the context of those decisions? And then for us specifically, for example, trying to tackle the sustainability side of things and the kind of building infrastructure for more sustainable consumption, we tend to frame it so that we're trying to, as software providers, you usually remove friction. That's kind of your role. There's already a process that is in place, and now you are there to build something that removes friction from that process, be it digitalization or automation or whatever. And now kind of your question is that, are we as leaders consciously enabling these highly educated individuals to take bigger risks so that we could speed up that friction remover faster? Or are we just kind of actually reducing our capabilities to the brain power of that individual leader, which tends to not always be the, like, human brain is a powerful machine, but at the end of the day, it doesn't have that much computational power compared to having independent decision makers and risk takers and solution builders.
Can you give us an example or two of how you have applied this philosophy of elevating and not delegating in Twice, or maybe in the previous ventures that you had?
Yeah, at Twice, we're looking at that quite consciously. So it is, well, I'm trying to think how do I kind of reduce a big thing into a small answer. But well, the first of personally, for example, how I try to look at things is that I tend to think about people as decision makers, and my role as a CEO to be such that I need to build a culture and a environment where people can make rapid conscious decisions. Because then if you are a startup, you're venture capital backed, you have, for example, obnoxiously big growth targets, that kind of usually means high risk, because high reward usually goes hand in hand with risk. I think that's proven by quite many academics. So consciously, I try to build this environment where individuals can make a lot of decisions extremely quickly and then consciously take risks. And then the question is that, how do we think about risk? I think historically, businesses have been thinking about risk only as a negative thing, but they kind of associate all of the uncertainty with negative risk. But in those uncertain scenarios, actually, there's a lot of positive upside risk. So then the question just is that, how do you floor that downside to something acceptable, whether it's a cost of business or cost of society or similar? And then how do you kind of then enable the fact that a lot of uncertainty, which includes those positive upsides, so all of that variance actually turns into potential outcomes, how do you kind of enable that? And to me, it is a lot of conscious communication around and enablement and elevation of people to make decisions. And then when they fail, because there will be a lot of failures, it's that, how do you kind of handle that failure matters 10x or 100 times better, more than how do you handle the good bet, so to say. So for me, it is an exercise of how do I enable fast amounts of small bets in short amount of time, acknowledge the fact that there will be failures, and how do you kind of handle them emotionally so that individuals learn and can kind of make a more educated bet the next time. Maybe that's, it's a little bit of a fluffy answer, but that's how I kind of try to be conscious about the fact that when I think about my output in micro discussions or then macro discussions.
But let's make it less fluffy, because I think there is a lot of value in this answer in general, because that's how leaders need to be thinking, right? So in practice, what does it mean? Maybe you have something in a culture statement about quick decisions or attitude towards failure. Maybe it's some phrases that you use in your one-to-ones when people come to you with questions like, Tuomo, should we do this or this? So any of those kind of practical tidbits that you could share?
Yeah, well, I can share two frameworks that we use. One of them, I think, was popularized by Spotify back in the day, which is DIBB, D-I-B-B. It stands for Data, Insights, Beliefs, and Bets. So one thing that we always kind of demand from anyone is that when you make these bets, you should be able to kind of state what beliefs you're basing this on and what insights and what data. And or then you can kind of disclaim the fact that I don't have data, I don't have insights, I just have a belief. So essentially a gut feel. And then if you have two people with gut feeling and the other one has 20 years of industry experience, yeah, maybe let's go with that gut feeling. But then if the other person has actually data and insights there. So that DIBB framework is in use in many places in our pre-reads. Usually before meetings, we tend to send pre-reads. So you formulate your bets so that you say, what's the beliefs backing up these? What's the insights and what's the data? And data and insights, we say, should always be objective. So, you know, if you show a data graph, you can kind of, the data points are objective. The data is what it is. The insights should be objective, saying things like it seems to be going up. The derivative is positive, but then the beliefs can become subjective. I think that this is due to this and this. So we kind of demand that everyone's capable of dissecting their arguments into this framework, which then makes it a lot more constructive and quicker for someone to just accept the bet or challenge their underlying data or belief rather than make it like a battle of opinions. Because then we have this, I don't know whether how well this translates, but we sometimes say that it's like, if you just come to the room and you just put out bets without being able to detail the beliefs, insights, and data behind them, it's almost like farting in the room. You just make the room smell bad and the other people have only the option to kind of stay in a stinky room or then leave because there's no way of going about it. That's one. And then we have three cultural values. It's ambitious, progressive, and no nonsense. So we remind ourselves that we need to make ambitious bets. So let's take that risk. Let's say that we can build a better world faster. Progressive, meaning that we have the courage to not only follow trends, but try to also establish them. And then no nonsense kind of connects to the fact that, you know, like you are, I think, now being good example of that. That let's get from the fluffy to the concreteness and challenge people to be no nonsense. So I think those are the three things that we try to do it so that the playing field is leveled and nobody can pull rank, but it's best ideas win and fastest decisions tend to win also.
How do you work on this no nonsense that everyone feels like it's done for the sake of the idea, not for the sake of smashing me as a person? Do you have any, key phrases to use, like, okay, so that people don't take it personally, or any exercises you do as a team building to really work on the psychological safety where it becomes easy to challenge the ideas without going into personal attacks or anything like this?
Yeah, that's an extremely hard one. I think we are practicing that also. I think what makes it also harder for startups is that, specifically, for example, with us, we have a lot of people that we might be their first workplace ever. Mm-hmm. So individuals might not have a yet quite conscious thinking around work-life separation and what you're kind of, I think nowadays people tend to kind of build their personal identity and work identity to be essentially the same thing. So then if someone attacks your work idea or bet and or criticizes or gives you redirecting feedback on that, it's if you don't have this separation of work-life, then you might kind of take that as a personal hit. And then when something becomes personal, the emotions are harder to kind of then manage. And, you know, usually it's like fear and hate are emotions and courage and kindness are decisions. So you kind of need these capabilities of how to separate these emotions from decisions, or kind of you experience the emotions, but then you need to have practiced the capabilities of how you actually handle those. So for us, I think we're constantly practicing that. But it goes back to that same idea that why I mentioned the fact that what matters more than maybe how do you handle the wins is that how do you handle the fails? Because then those are the moments where you build that psychological safety. And it happens via iteration that people first need to fail and then see that the world didn't end. And then you can go through that failure. Like failing without learning is not a good thing. But if you learn from something from it, then it's a good thing. And it's I've sometimes used as an example in the company to try to kind of give context to people and maybe to build psychological safety that it's usually, I don't know, by the way, if this is true, but I think it tells the right story that kids do not learn how to walk. They learn how not to fall. So It's kind of, I haven't yet heard about a kid who would have just started walking by, like looking at it, thinking there might be a couple of those there. But most of the kids that I've seen tend to fumble first. And then you first need those small fumbles in order to figure it out. And that's kind of what we try to also remind people, that these fumbles are part of the learning process. And let's rather fumble quickly and fast so that we learn, and then we learn to walk, and then we learn to run, and we will fumble. And the faster you go, the more the fumble will hurt, to be honest. But then, yeah, I think these are the no-nonsense things on how to go about it. But yeah, I think it's a conscious effort that you need to invest some time and resources towards to make it work.
I love what you said about that fear and anger are emotions, and courage and kindness are a choice. And that's what I talk about quite often when I talk about self-leadership, that it's not about being a good leader of yourself. It's not about never getting the emotion. Like, it's natural. They are there to protect you, to get you to survive and keep your life, right? But then self-leadership comes in after that emotion. What do you do with that? Creating space in between that first emotion or first thought and your decision, or the second thought, what kind of story do you build based on that first thought? That is that self-leadership, to making that space as long as possible or as big as possible so that you actually can be active with that decision. So just like being courageous, being kind, and so on, despite the first emotion. And I love how you say that you're using these analogies with walking, for example. Then people can relate to that, and people can start understanding that. And it becomes easier to see the failure in a different perspective, right? Because like, okay, I'm walking. Then it means that I have been failing, right? And falling as a kid while learning to do that. So, okay, then maybe I can try to do that in my professional context right now at here at Vice. And okay, what would be my first fumble? What would it be my crawling? And so on and so forth. So people can start translating that experience. Because quite often I notice that even the most brilliant and smart leaders I work with forget that they have experiences outside of this particular context. So they might have perfect skills to solve this problem, but it's because it's from their sports career, what is their hobby. They don't think that they can apply it in this particular work situation. And I'm like, okay, but what do you do there when you're on the field? Yeah, I do this and this and this and this and this. And then you see like this light bulb going up over their head. It's like, wait a moment. Yeah, I can do it. So just always think about it. Like, you are a whole being, and it's not about bringing your whole being there. As you say, some separation of identities is important, but we can always get those experiences, translate them from one context to another, from one of our roles to another. And as leaders, we can just encourage that and support that, and maybe show by our own example how we do it in our lives.
Definitely. I think it boils down to that consciousness, that are you consciously being able to kind of make these decisions and decision making and all of that. What came to mind from that is that for any listener, that might be a practical thing that we've found sometimes. For example, I think in many organizations, whatever your kind of, let's say, organizational rhythm or metronome is, that whether you're setting daily, weekly, monthly goals or whatever the forum is, I'm pretty sure that most have experienced that, where you're again making those goals and you're setting those goals, but somehow you just feel that this goal is quite fluffy. It's somehow you can see a world where when we get to the point where we look at whether we actually reached it or not, we can make it to be anything. Yes, we reached it because we tried our best, or something like that. So one of the things that we've found that works sometimes is that we ask that, what might be something that we can fail at by this time, or what's the failure? So rather than actually talking about the measurement or the success case, let's talk about what would the failure look like. Work, for example, with influencers. The failure would look like so that the influencer doesn't understand what we're doing, actually doesn't like us, and ends up building the biggest hate campaign against our brand. So then that looks like failure. And then maybe that's a nice way of finding that's a little bit scary. But maybe that scariness or that emotion starts to tell that this is the place where actually we can make most of the impact, that this is a thing that we could do. So that sometimes have kind of led us to a good place. And then as an individual, one thing that I also, when you find yourself in one of those days where you're kind of automating, just your brain is, any given Tuesday, your brain is just a little bit on automation mode. When someone asks you something which is like a piece of soap that you cannot really take, that So then I kind of reduce myself always to asking that, what is the decision that I can make that makes your life easier now? So I kind of ask them that, what's the decision that they want me to make? And I found that that as a boilerplate question leads usually to an actionable place where either that individual might say that actually I don't need your any decisions. I'm just maybe scared. So at the end of the day, I just want to check whether this is okay or similar. And then you can kind of encourage them to take the bet. Or then you find that, hey, it's your bottleneck in some ridiculous process. And then let's make a decision that I'm not part of this process anymore or something like that.
Brilliant. Both advice are very practical, very useful in so many applications. So thanks so much, Tomo, for sharing them. When you gave us the analogy of walking, learning to walk, and then you said like, okay, and then we'll be able to start running, right? And then, okay, we'll still fumble when we're running and that hurts. The faster you run, the more it hurts to fall. How do you deal with that personally whenever those entrepreneurial falls happen? What are your steps to get yourself through that moment?
I think it's a combination of many things. For me, like we touched upon in the beginning of the episode, I have those personal experiences where if I've forgotten whether this fall is a hard fall or not, like I can always go back to a specific moment and know that this fall actually isn't like so bad. It's this is just a slight fumble that might feel for someone as a big fall. Just to me, it's just a small fumble. So that's one of those things that really helps me to level the playing field in many cases. You know, I think it's the other kind of way of doing about it is just taking good care of yourself, which I fail usually during fundraising seasons. I might fail to kind of reach that. But I think that's really a place where if you're in a good shape mentally and physically, so you can do physical training and you can do therapy and all of that to keep yourself in shape, to be able to make those conscious decisions to kind of take that emotion and then decide how you act upon it. I think that's really kind of why it's so important to keep yourself recovered and understand that, you know, tired people make incremental decisions. And if you're in the business of building, for example, ventures, like venture capital ventures, you need to make some threshold defining big magnitude decisions. And those are super hard to do if you're tired because you just lack the capability of tackling those emotions. So that's kind of something where I kind of have my own ways of trying to figure out, like remind myself of this equation and understanding that if I've ended up in a place where I'm too tired, you need to first fix that. You cannot just like screw it tighter. You will, you know, at some point it will kind of explode the whole setup.
But it's so hard to do in the moment when you're already overwhelmed, when you feel like there is so much to do. How do you force yourself? Like, I know it for myself, the challenge is real. I have mental health days on every month. I set a workday when the whole workday I'm just not doing anything work related. And usually I'm just doubling down on pleasure things. And I try to keep that day as free as possible. So it might be one meeting with a friend, but otherwise, or like a massage, but then nothing else scheduled so that I don't need to rush and I just go with the flow. And every time, I kid you not, every time I've done it now for 3 years, the night before, I'm like, maybe I should skip it tomorrow. There are all these things to do. And like, I really want to get them done. And every time once I've done that mental health day, I don't regret it. But that's because I have committed myself to this one day per month, right? But as a startup founder, I'm building a lifestyle business for myself, right? As a startup founder, you have so many responsibilities. And if you are in this moment of like, spinning the wheels because you need to hustle a bit up and make more sales so that actually, or close that funding round so that you can pay the salaries this month to your employees. How do you force yourself to pause and get that restful time for yourself? And it doesn't need to be the whole workday, but any tricks there?
Well, I think the things that have enabled me to become better at that is to understand kind of what my skin in the game is. So kind of understanding what is the actual, like, what's pushing me forward? So what's the monetary skin in the game? And what's the kind of passion side of things? And for me, I've always had that will of, like, for example, there's this, it's come from a fellowship that I'm part of. I think it's an Irish playwright called Andrew Bernard who say that reasonable people adapt themselves to the world, unreasonable people adapt the world to themselves. So I think I've been always a little bit of an unreasonable person in the good and the bad, that, you know, if someone says that cannot be done, I just tend to think that it's not yet done. And then I start building it. So I think for me, it's kind of having that some kind of core thing inside me that pushes me to that direction. And then just having fumbled enough that I've learned these tricks that I've written to myself this kind of operating system on how I run and these belief systems that I document. And sometimes I've been invited to lecture about those into like, for example, Aalto MBA students as a like 1 hour setup of these belief systems. And I think those have been super helpful, even though they would be academically wrong or they wouldn't be holistic frameworks. But having a documented system allows you to then remind on those pressure moments that, hey, I've written this thing down for me, that this is how I think that I should operate. And then probably partly due to that, it's something that we've also incorporated to our organization, because then when you fall, you need those people that pick you up or that you kind of surround yourself with people and processes that remind you about this thing. And I could imagine that you have that like recurring calendar event or similar. That's kind of your mini people organization that say kind of comes down knocking on your door and say that it seems to be time to recover, because month is, you know, you need that recovery day per month. So I think it's just consciously building these frameworks and processes around you that support this kind of thing, and then documenting those beliefs so that you understand why are you making this bet, even though it would be a investor or the big board member that is pressing on your neck. You kind of, I think I've reached that point where I know that, hey, I know my operating system, and I know that if you want me to do even bigger impact, I need to think about it a little bit. So maybe these are the things. It's practical stuff like writing stuff down and making sure you have those processes around you that help you when you don't know how to help yourself.
Yeah, definitely. We need to automate those things for ourselves, right? As you said, like, okay, my day is there is a recurring one on my calendar. And I have my husband for last month. We had this funny story when I was in the organizational committee of some one-day event. And we're planning the next call with each other to check in on the status, delegate it, or like distribute the tasks between ourselves and so on. And they were like, oh, how about tomorrow? And I looked at my calendar, I was like, mental health. And I was like, okay, it's just half an hour. I was like, I can do that in between the pool and a walk or something. And I was like, yeah, I could do it there and then. And then my husband, my the door to the office was open and he was standing there and he was like, mental health day. And I started laughing like, okay, ladies, no, actually not. I can't. I'm committed to not working. And that's that. Like, I need to do that. So we do need that support, as you said, from our calendar, from the our employees, our team, personal network, and so on. And what you said with the operating system, I really love that you have that and that you emphasize the importance of having the time to sit down and write, because that is such a powerful tool. And it boils down again to self-awareness. And you started talking about that from your experiences in the military, right? As a young adult, you're coming in there and they teach you a lot about yourself. They force you to understand yourself much better. And that's something we all need to do to be able to operate at a higher level, thinking in that visionary term of like, I can bend the reality. It just hasn't been done yet, and so on. Journaling, introspection, all those things are really important for that.
Definitely. And then I think one thing that we've been, like as a final note, like I think we touched upon it a little bit, but when we're talking about the work-life separation, but often I also, like, I think one thing that I've learned throughout the years of being someone might categorize as a passion-driven entrepreneur or impact-driven entrepreneur is that I've learned so many times that like passion is like fire. It's a great servant, but an extremely poor master. That when you go to that mode, that this needs to work and I'm getting up, like just to kind of all of a sudden kind of the passion has been taking the driver's seat and you're just serving the passion and you're just kind of, that's the point where you need to stop and figure out how do you make the passion again a servant and not a master, because then you are losing track of why are you doing things and you're losing that conscious decision making. So that's often, for example, if I meet with new entrepreneurs and whatever their ask is, whether it's like in hiring or fundraising, my favorite question to ask from them is that, what is your goal as an entrepreneur? Why did you become an entrepreneur? I just want to kind of hear whether they've had an idea and they feel that now I need to get this idea working no matter what, and how much structure they've built around their capability of asking help and figuring out how do they operationalize the resources that they might get throughout the journey. Because at the end of the day, I think that's what matters the most, and that what's their kind of game plan and ability to understand that game plan.
Such a powerful mind shift there, Tomo, about this passion and what kind of seat it should have in our vehicle of life. It's a very important reflection to point to have. Do you have any specific prompts to help you reflect on that, or maybe any warning signs or symptoms when you're like, okay, yeah, now passion is in the driving seat and I need to force it to park the car and we swap. Any practical advice there?
Yeah, I think it's, at least this applies to like a entrepreneur. We tend to start the things that we do because we want to do them. And then if you start to get the emotions that now I'm kind of doing this for someone else, let's say that you have an investor or similar, and you're kind of starting to lose that understanding of I'm doing this because I want to do it, then it starts to be something else. It starts, you're not consciously anymore making the bet. And entrepreneurship, I think, is so hard emotional, or you need to have emotional support and reflection that if you're not consciously making the decision to do that, it's, I give you like 6 months before you're burned out. So I think that's one of those like prompts that, like, am I today selecting to be an entrepreneur? That's the question. And if I kind of give me that conscious moment that do I actually decide to be an entrepreneur or not? And I think that's for me one of those things that I try to figure it out, that who am I doing this for? That might be one of those things. I'm trying to think that what else might be these kind of ways to go about it. But I think emotionally, that's the emotion that I listen to the most, that who am I doing this for?
I think that's enough. It's such a powerful question to ask yourself, and should be fairly simple to answer. And that's why there is so much power in it, because you can just honestly say to yourself, no, right now I'm just doing it because, yeah, I'm doing it for the investors. I don't have myself invested there anymore. I guess one day it's all right to have that answer, right?
Definitely.
It becomes a pattern.
Yeah, definitely. And it's okay to have that answer every year at some point, but then it gives you this idea that, okay, I logged in now the emotion that actually I'm now doing this in order to kind of secure the funding to, you know, like you said earlier, pay the salaries. But then you can kind of give yourself then a actionable time frame to say that I'm going to give myself a 2 months. I can do this for 2 months. But then if I haven't figured this out, or if I haven't yet felt that I'm doing it because I want to do it, then I go to something else. So it kind of allows you to kind of set a tone that for how long am I willing to stay in this mode? Because definitely every year, every month, you might have those feelings that today I'm going to work to, you know, elevate all of the great people that work in the company, but me as an individual would rather stay in bed reading a book, and which has nothing to do with business, or listening to, I don't know, Team Coco, Conan is a Friend, and just like nothing to do with business. But yeah, so I think that as long as you kind of stop in that moment and ask yourself that how long am I willing to accept this? Because if it's your kid needing, you know, a family needing resources, you might be willing to do that for a whole lifetime, because that is a quite powerful driver. But maybe not a private equity investor, is not maybe someone who you might want to serve for your whole life.
Amen to that. I always emphasize that it's okay sometimes to not have one area of your life in perfect check, but as long as it's an intentional and proactive choice of yours, and you know the deadline to that when you reevaluate, it's fine. But if it just becomes just because out of some momentum or vice versa inertia, then that becomes a warning sign that we need to discuss. Toma, you just last question before we start wrapping up. You talked about the choices, right? And you have been like, now it's the third venture that you're building in the sustainability space, trying to create solutions that will help people to make better choices. How are your personal choices when it comes to circularity and sustainability?
I would categorize myself as if there's a normal curve of people in the world, and there's like lazy and active in terms of how aware are you in how you consume, I would put myself pretty much in the middle. So as an individual, I'm not always the best example when it comes to sustainability. I kind of, as a consumer, I value convenience quite a lot. I try to make quite a lot of conscious decisions on what kind of food I consume or what kind of clothes I wear. But at the end of the day, I would not categorize myself as the most, let's say, that my decisions, the actual actions that I make, would be a reflection of like a someone that I would categorize as the best, most eco-friendly consumer, which might be a odd thing looking at what we do as a company, that as a founder, I've been co-founding a business that aims to remove friction from that. Well, that kind of makes sense because I'm maybe too lazy of a consumer that I felt that I need to have a better ways of consuming more eco-friendly. So let's build that infrastructure. But also connecting maybe to your earlier question is that to me, it's the idea that I'm putting 8 to 12 hours a day, my brain, to figuring out how do I build infrastructure for the world that would be a leverage for the whole global system to go be more eco-friendly. So that's at least one mechanism that I kind of give myself a little bit of slack sometimes, even though it might be kind of my mental greenwashing inside my head. But that's one of the things. But yeah, that's how I would categorize myself. I'm not necessarily the most best example of a sustainable consumer, or let's say I'm in the normal curve of a Nordic consumer, if that there's a statistic on that.
I would not use the word best here, but I would say, first of all, thank you so much for the transparency and honesty here, because I think it's important, because quite often we stop ourselves when we have this passion to do something and then we're like, oh, but I'm not perfect at that. Imagine that you would be thinking of that, like, okay, there are those lazy and active or whatever you use as a scale of the bell curve. And like, okay, you have this idea for twice, but you're like, nah, I'm not the perfect consumer myself. I'm not on that active end of the bell curve. So no, I'm not going to start this. And then you're not creating the impact and not creating a solution that actually lowers the friction for so many businesses to create the solutions that will be easy to use for so many people. So I think it's important for us to understand that we don't have to be perfect ourselves to help someone else. And of course, we still need to be mindful and we need to make our choices, right? You're saying like, okay, I'm trying to be conscious about my food choices, my clothing, but I decide for myself where the limits or maybe in which areas I have non-negotiables, and in the others, I can give myself some slack and I feel like, okay, this is not the most optimal, but right now for me to maximize the use of my brain power, this is what I need to do. So it becomes a bit of this kind of small, I like how my therapist once said, Anna, you cannot remove the tumor if you don't cut the person open.
Mm. Yeah.
And for me, it was like, whoa, that's powerful, because yes, we need to hurt the person in the short term to maybe save their lives so that they actually have a decade more to live.
Makes total sense. Definitely. And I think it's like, I don't want to compare our build a comparison where we'd be a doctor, because I think too highly of a doctor, but then let's imagine so that if you would hear that a doctor would kind of say that, yeah, I'm not gonna study lung cancer because I smoke cigarettes myself. I would ask like, please do. Like, you don't have to be a best example of the health choices. You can still kind of try to make an impact for everyone else. So yeah, I think it's nowadays we have a culture where quite small things out of everyone's life is being evaluated, whether they kind of live by a quite strict standard that they've themselves built or someone else have built. So yeah, I think it would be an extremely sad thing if people do not start those ventures that try to help the world just because they feel that they don't live completely up to a standard that might be actually impossible to live to in many cases.
Or if you live up to that standard, that just takes all your life. You can't build anything because you're just living up to the standard.
Exactly.
Tomo, if people are thinking like, okay, I want to be more eco-conscious, eco-friendly with my choices as an individual, whatever they do in their professional life, which areas would you suggest? Or maybe some questions. There is a clear hierarchy. Okay, start with this area or this product. Or if there is no clear hierarchy, maybe some questions for people to reflect. Okay, what would be that hierarchy for me personally?
Definitely. I'll try to stick to the stuff that I actually know about, but kind of there's the kind of the global footprint. I think that there's a lot better people than me kind of going through all of the choices that you can make. But I think to me, where my own choices really start is just thinking about your consumption a little bit. And then if you have that option to buy something that has once been used by someone else, giving someone the kind of the second life, that's to me a decision that you should kind of always aim to do. Also, the world is such a place that the more we have durable and quality goods, the more we have chances to repair them or reuse them. So really thinking that maybe saving up one extra month more to buy that more premium product might be the thing if you have the luxury to do so. That's something where I try to kind of that I try to live by, that I more and more try buy premium goods, because then I tend to think that, well, there is more life cycle included in this for someone else. I think those are the things that really, really kind of, I would advise, for any other advice, eco-conscious decisions, I would go to great resources like Ellen MacArthur Foundation and such that have a lot of science-backed information on the decisions that you can make on a consumption level or other level. Personally, one thing that I've been working on is just on my dietary selection, that cutting down as much as meat as I can, as being that kind of, I think, is one of the quite impactful things that an individual can do every day in a grocery store. But otherwise, I would kind of refer everyone to go to, for example, Ellen MacArthur Foundation and read from the science-backed information and not necessarily listen to Tuomolainen on a podcast as your life choices when it comes to eco-friendliness, having just said that I'm not necessarily the best example myself also.
But I think, again, we need to go back to best is not necessarily the most valuable example, right? They're realistic. As you said, you making your choices, you deciding what is the important part where you can really give yourself some space to make those less conscious decisions. But again, it's conscious and intentional, and you know why you're doing it, for the bigger impact creation that you're actually using your resources for that. So I appreciate that. Anything you think we haven't covered so far, which is important to mention in the field of what TWICE is doing, in the personal choices of people or leadership and personal development?
Yeah, I think we've covered a lot of ground. So thank you for that. Excellent. Like, this has been an excellent discussion. I think I have to write some reflections after this also to kind of improve my own operating system. I think as a final reminder, maybe, or one thing that I'd like to kind of remind people that when it comes to, for example, TWICE commerce and the change that we're driving around sustainability, especially, let's say, in the Nordic European discussion, there's quite a lot now. In general, the discussion has been around value alignment and saying how important things are. But I think it's time to start to move as much as we can the discussion towards incentive alignment, because where you, if you show me incentives, I will show you action. So for businesses, especially in durable goods side, kind of retailers and manufacturers, I would invite anyone to join into that field to focus on the profitability side of things. How do you prove the profitability of all of these business models in short term and long term? Because one thing that I kind of experience quite regularly when talking with brands and retailers is that they all actually have the value alignment there. They say, we have this sustainability program. We've had a lot of consultation on that. We know our footprint. But the one thing that we kind of lack is that Excel that shows us how do we actually make gross margin out of it. We have some, like, compared to all of the other Excels that we use in the business, this one has fewest rows, and it's almost like a university financial model level, whereas everything else is modeled to the smallest detail. So I think I would invite any business person or anyone capable of helping there to join that effort, because we really need that to figure out how do we better talk about profitability, how do we better talk about revenue and how businesses can make more money out of circularity, because that is the case. They just lack the kind of Excels to prove that. And as we get more and more of those, I'd say that that's the way to speed up the change. And maybe to be a little bit provocative, the time for value alignment in many scenes is gone. And now let's talk about profitability when it comes to sustainability.
I love it. And it goes back to one of my first questions, right? It sounds good as a business or for my own consciousness, but where is the business case in this idea of circularity? So I really appreciate your invitation, Tom, to everyone who is in that field to practice, to find that messaging, to continuously improve it so that it becomes a bit more of a non-brainer every day for the decision makers in the businesses. Like, okay, why should we do this? Why should we choose this over that? And so on. Thank you so much. And thank you for the feedback about the conversation. And this is something I love about Genius Leadership, that this is when guests afterwards saying, like, I've never thought about this. I've never talked about it this way. As you said, I need to go and reflect myself, review my personal beliefs and so on. This is the best for me, because if I made you reflect, I bet our genius leaders listening have reflected as well. So I appreciate our conversation and your honesty and all the knowledge you've shared today, Tomo.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
And to you, genius leaders listening, I just want to remind you, as always, that I see you, I feel you, and I love you. And I do believe that you can make those better choices for yourself, more conscious choices that will make you feel good. and make you help you optimize your use of brain power. So go make those choices. Start small. Don't try to be perfect. Try to be realistic. Love you and talk to you next week.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Genius Leadership Podcast. If you enjoyed the conversation, hit the subscribe button. Please rate, review, and share to help more people discover the show and become the better leaders. For more conversations about living in your zone of genius, connect with me on LinkedIn. Genius Leadership is an honest conversation about leading yourself and others, and it is my honor to be a guide in overcoming everything.